So is everybody getting mails that are being sent? So whoever did not get, I mean, there are already several mails sent on the class mailing list. For example, that's all the mails that have been sent since last class. So if you're not getting this, that means you're not yet on the mailing list. Make sure that you come and give me your email address at the end of the class, okay? Probably because it was not listed in the, you probably did not list your email address in the registration list. That might explain why, okay? I could, of course, try to say, I can't find this out by email myself, so I have to ask you. Okay. So are there any questions from last class? I have the same set of people from last class, I hope, at least a subset. So there was a last class, and so are there any questions on this stuff? Okay, I sent a mail asking people to think of examples of queries that they think are not correctly, not well answered by the current search engines. Okay, has anybody, and that was going to be part of the first homework zeros problem now. So I just added that. I assume several of you got this, except for the two or three who said they didn't have their email addresses on the list. So are there any examples that people will give me of queries? I mean, this was actually also, you're going to do it anyway for the homework, but can you give me some examples of the kinds of queries that you think are not well answered by, I mean, they don't have proper support for them. The query doesn't have to be what Google allows you. You know, I mean, if you start thinking that way, of course, yeah, you know, what it does well. But you have to ask yourself other kinds of queries that you might be interested in. Yes? No, don't tell me what it does. Tell me, give me an example query of example, something that you wanted to do. A query doesn't have to be keyword query at all. You wanted to do something on the internet and you are unable to get reasonable support for that. Yes? You just want the answer, okay, but I guess won't Google do it if you say I'm feeling lucky button, it will take you to the page. Is that considered an answer? Okay. Other answer, other, yes. There is one thing that's common between all the answers that I heard till now, which is you're still very much in the mindset of what search engines want you to be in. Put yourself in those days when we just about invented the wheel and we found like an ox cart. You know, we made an ox cart. And if I'm asking you, what do you think, are there things that you might want to do transportation-wise other than ox cart? Don't keep telling me, if only I have like rubber tires on the ox cart, or if the oxen had like nicer looking, you know, ornaments on their head, it would be better. You know that there's a lot more you can do transportation-wise. I mean, now, of course, at least you know, there's a lot more that you can do transportation-wise than, you know, going by an ox cart in a slow pace, right? Part of what's interesting is any sufficiently successful technology would make you think of the world in its terms. Okay, so you are in essence thinking there's nothing that Google doesn't do well, because what Google does is what you're thinking you really wanted. Okay, it would be, so try harder. Try to do things other than just keyword searches or variations of keyword searches on the web, and see whether you could come up with things that you might want to do. Again, think of this ox cart metaphor. There are things. I mean, it's like we shouldn't have poverty of imagination. Yes. Real-time traffic report. Okay. Yes, sir. Okay. So suppose I want to know the number of State Department employees who make more salary than the median salary of the Arizona State University professor. And I'm sorry, I didn't talk about keywords. This is a question I might want to ask. Is there answer for this question on the web? Does anything that you know do it for you? You do it yourself. Okay. Here is another example. National Science Foundation funds, of course, most of the basic research, right? So one day they wanted to answer the following very simple question. They have tons and tons of data sources. They keep data in them. And they wanted to answer the following question: how much money have we given to support basic research in historically black and underrepresented colleges? It's clear that they have this information on their databases. You know how long it took for them to find that number? One full week. One full week of a government employee. Okay, and so they use this to start an entire new initiative called Intelligent Information Integration Initiative. And if NSF has a problem, they can always pour money into it. And you and I can't. But again, the reason I'm bringing this up is you should not think that the only thing that you could do with web is what you can do with either Google or Vivissimo. Okay, so you might want to keep that in the back of your head. Any other comment on this? Yes. Okay. Again, so I think it would be an interesting exercise. I mean, part of what I'm trying to do here is to kind of make your imagination slightly more elastic than being extremely close to what you can already do. Okay. So I don't know that this is directly related to, I mean, change comes from discontent, right? If you're too darn happy with the way things are, you know, it's like, I mean, you know, you would not going to change anything. So the question is, where's your discontent with respect to web? I mean, if you're so darn content, then you should just go buy Google Shares or whatever the latest search engine shares are, and, you know, forget wasting time taking courses, right? Because I know that you probably want to get a job in Google, which is another way, you know, rather than think up our own ideas, just join somebody else, which is fine too. But I think there should be discontent. Okay? I mean, you know, there is a lot more that can be done on the web than you are able to do. And don't be so happy about what you are able to do, you know, that you would not think about it, what other things to do. Okay? And as the course goes on, we will see variations of things that can be done. But I think I want you to also think of what is worth doing and ask yourself, why can't we do it? Okay, it's very important to think that way, you know, because that's where, you know, change will come. Anyway, so I did ask people to send me links, and till now only one person sent. You know, I have this open invitation to people to send me interesting websites that are related to the aims of this course that people can actually look at. So a9.com, of course, is the Amazon's version of search. So they're trying to do Google for Amazon. Okay. So does anybody know why it's called A9? Of course, most people don't even know that there are other search engines other than Google. which actually gets back to today's New York Times article that, in fact, Google is the new Microsoft in terms of, the Silicon Valley people now are very worried about Google at the same way they used to be worried about Microsoft. And somewhere in that article it says, Microsoft has now become IBM and Google has now become Microsoft, which basically possibly means, I guess, that there is a place for a new Google to start, a new Google version to start. But anyway, A9 is again worth looking at. It's a different kind of search engine. It is, again, nobody knows what algorithms these guys are using, but you can at least see whether they are any better in terms of search effectiveness. Okay. The word, the A9 stands for the number of letters in the word algorithm. Okay. That's the word, that's where the A9 comes from. This is the kind of thing, geekish computer scientists are very happy about. And the guy who actually is running A9 is Udi Manbar, who used to be a professor of computer science at University of Arizona before and was doing some backwaters research on string matching sorts of things. In fact, he did a original search engine called Glimpse. And then suddenly those things became actually useful. And so he was gobbled up by, first I think Yahoo, and then he was gobbled up by Amazon, and then Amazon took him back in Silicon Valley to do this A9. And one interesting thing about A9, which has really not much technical content to this, is since all the search engines now are trying to combine satellite imagery with the maps, for example, if you are into maps, right? So A9 guys, what they did was they actually said, well, looking at the world this way is no good. Okay, when I'm going on the road, I look at the shop this way, not this way, down on the shop. So they got a bunch of vans, outfitted them with video cameras and real-time digitization and so on, and so they had these things going on the roads in pretty much every reasonable town. So in fact, you would be very surprised, you can get pictures of Mill Avenue. If you give a Mill Avenue address, and it'll show you pictures of Mill Avenue, and you can actually traverse on Mill Avenue. You can keep going this side and that side, just the same way satellite imagery works, except this, you can actually see what's going on. I mean, the shops and their windows and so on. So that's their current claim to fame, except they haven't really, I don't think the very fact that none of you know it means, they haven't really got into you yet. If you are representative of the random population of other people. Okay, so that's A9.com. They have, I don't actually know that there's any interesting technical things that they're doing that I could tell you about, but, go look at it anyway. Okay. So, I asked in my email whether or not there were a set of slides that I did not go through in the last class, and those were available to you. And I asked whether I should go through these in front of you or you think it's repetition. I'm giving you the choice. And I'm assuming that, as I have no other work and keep sending you emails, you have no other work and keep reading emails. Okay? So it's a reasonable assumption, symmetrically good one. So the question is, Has anybody looked at this slide? Any questions? Yes? It's fine. Let us skip. Okay. Anybody else has any? What exactly is the sentence structure? Any other comments? Okay. So I should tell you another meta comment, which is I'm more worried about boring people than about not making too much sense and overwhelming you. Okay, so it would be good if you don't understand, ask me, rather than me assuming that you don't understand and repeating things. Okay, so that's part of the reason I brought this up. But let's very quickly go through this stuff. Let's see. Maybe it's sort of connected to something that was being asked in the beginning of the class. So this is again what sorts of things one might want to do with web and trying to connect information retrieval, mining, and integration to those sorts of things. So at some level, it depends, what you want to do with web depends on what you view web as, okay? So in fact, if I go slowly, I would say web is viewed as a large collection of, and I'll put a dash and ask you to fill the blank. Okay, and different people fill the blank in different ways, and that sort of tells you their bias as to what's actually on the web and what they expect to do with the web. So really, web currently has pretty much everything, but a lot of it is text, semi-structured data, as well as structured data. Now, you know what text is, hopefully. And you know what structured data is. Do you know what structured data is? What is structured data? All databases. So if you are in doubt, think of the database tuples as structured data. Okay. So does web actually have databases on the web? You guys know that they do exist, right? I mean, in fact, a large number of pages that are generated for human consumption are actually being generated by a back-end database. Okay. So there is a lot more structured data, and as I said earlier, you are actually accessing fabric. Anytime you go to a travel engine, okay? So there is structured data, there is text. Now there is this whole thing about semi-structured data, which is, it's not completely structured, but neither is it completely non-structured, okay? An example of semi-structured data would be an email message, okay? Think of email messages. They have certain fields that are basically, every message will have like a from field, a to field, and some information about which machine the message has passed through and so on. These come in pretty standardized form, and these can actually be read by machines. And then there's a body field, which is completely unstructured, which is just text. Okay, so if you assume that email is completely text, you would say, since I can't do natural language processing, I don't want to process email. If you assume it's completely structured, then you're missing the point that the bottom of the body of the email is actually unstructured. Okay, so there is a lot of such data. In many, many pages, there are parts of the page that displayed which has a lot of structure in it, and there is part which has no structure. Okay, now why do we care about the difference between structured and unstructured data? So first of all this data, you might want to search, browse, aggregate, so combine data from different sources to make new inferences and so on. Now, how to do these things and how much of these things you can do depends a lot upon the data. Okay, and the keyword there happens to be structured. The more structured your data is, the more inferences and the more combinations of data from different sources you get to be able to do. Okay, if it's unstructured data, there's only one entity that seems to be able to infer with unstructured data, and that's all. Humans can read English and, you know, answer questions on that. Okay, some of us do better than others based on our comprehension skills. But essentially, that's natural language processing. Okay, whereas structured data, you can do the whole database technology. All sorts of things like that are essentially about how to combine, in database, for example, you're always combining tables from different tables, joining and taking projections and so on. Okay, so the important thing winds up being structure, and if the more structure there is, the more kinds of interesting questions you can answer without doing full natural language processing. Okay, the less structure there is, the more of Google sort of stuff you're able to do. Okay, if it's all text, then what you can do is what Google does. There's more structure, you can do databases. And nobody actually ever thought that databases is like the zenith of inference perfection. Except when you are in the text world, that looks like something much better. Because all you can do in text is show a bunch of pages where the query words that you asked happen to appear. You're never giving answers. Whereas databases at least give answers. Okay? So now, one of the interesting things then is if there is no structure, sometimes you can extract structure from the pages. The interesting point here is a lot of pages, as I said earlier, a lot of pages on the web are actually generated by back-end databases. So they were structured at one time. And they felt that you guys don't like tuples, you know, with angle brackets. And so they converted into Pidgin English and showed it to you. Okay, now unfortunately, because they convert into English, none of these programs can actually do much with it. None of your usual programs can do much with it. So before you can actually do some inference, you may want to have to reconvert it back. Okay, that's a classic case of information extraction where you're essentially reverse engineering what somebody did. Okay, but there are also more general cases of information extraction where you actually do have full text pages. And while I said natural language processing as a whole is pretty hard problem, still a large there are aspects of text comprehension that we can do. So for example, I can read pages and extract tuples of the form, the capital of this country is this city. I can extract it, even though these are actually normal text pages. Okay, so natural language full, not doable. Natural language light is actually doable. And we are going more and more towards full natural language processing, you know, as the state of the art is. Okay, so in such cases too, in fact, information extraction is an important issue. Okay, so basically I said structure is important, and I said one way of getting the structure is to reverse engineer and then go back to the, you know, if it was a structured tuple which was converted into English, reconvert it back to structured format. The other way is try to actually extract structured information from text. And there is yet another third way, which is, you know, tell people, thou shalt write structured pages. Okay? Who does that? I mean, you must write only structured pages. We won't take non-structured pages anymore. Okay? We, the management of the web. Unfortunately, there is no management of the web. So you can see how far this idea is going to go. But in fact, the whole idea of semantic web, which, how many of you have heard the word semantic web? Semantic web assumes that, I mean, there would come a time where people can be goaded into writing largely structured pages. And people like you are bristling at the thought, hey, I'm so unique, I'm so, you know, different from everybody else, I would never follow standards. I would write my own page. As you're saying this, you are busily using some Netscape Composer or some Microsoft front page to make your page. Okay, unfortunately, so I'll stop there and then come back to my point, which is, it looks as if I started by saying semantic web is not likely to work because people can't be made to write structured web pages. But I started changing my point as I said, most of you guys are writing pages through front page and Netscape Composer and all this, and Netscape Composer dead probably, somebody else, you know, whatever is your latest homepage maker. Okay, now I don't need to convince you guys to be structured. I just need to infiltrate your web page maker. And there are only a few people left in the world like me who actually write HTML in the raw. I mean, the entire homepage, I just set my own HTML in the raw. Okay, so I'll probably never become semantic web. But the guys who are coming up now who are going to use front pages, etc. If the front page winds up asking you some harmless questions and start tagging your data as you are entering, start tagging your page as you are entering it, then without your knowledge, you have actually put structure into your page. Okay, so that's a different, a third approach for introducing structure into the web pages. And so now much of the work that happens in semantic web, and we might look at it towards the end of the course, is if this were to succeed, there would be certain problems still left. Even if in fact I am able to infiltrate your web page writing habits such that they become more and more structured, there are still some problems that are left before I can exploit that structure. Okay. So as an example, suppose somebody is about to write some page some page of papers, let's say, you know, computer science technical papers. And so he's being asked the question, so this thing that you just entered, what is it called? Okay. And this guy says author name. And somebody else who's asked the same question says writer name. Now, is author name the same as writer name? To you, of course, because you think these are similar, okay? But for a program, this is a string, they're not at all connected. So there's still this issue of making sure that vocabulary in which different pages structure has been described has to be put together. And that's a question that becomes important in semantic web. And so people are trying to solve those problems while waiting for the rest of you guys to catch up and start writing structured pages. Okay? So I think this piece, I spent a lot of time on this piece is important because increasingly you are interested in increasing the structure on the web. Either extract it or make it structured. And you should ask yourself, why are we so crazy about structure? And the answer is because what? Why are we so crazy about structure? And so basically you can infer more things if you have more structure. Do people actually have a clue about this? Do people really feel it in their bones that if only there was more structure, I can answer more questions? How many of you don't see that? I couldn't see it, so I admit. Okay, so you can admit too if you have trouble. Okay, so it's a subtle point. Once you realize this, you realize why it is important. Anyway, so we'll get to that point in a minute. So here basically the three different examples of structured versus semi-structured. A web page is just a text web page on one hand, an employee record on the other hand, and a movie review in the middle. Movie review is a semi-structured thing in most cases, because most reviews will have like a rating up front. You know, the rating can be A, B, C, or two thumbs up and one thumb down, or, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that's structured still. And then comes this, you know, bunch of text, which unfortunately you can't, you know, you can't process if you're just a program. Okay? So movie review is an example of semi-structured data. So how will the kind of search and querying on these three types of data differ? And before I go there, I actually also want to say that the way these kinds of structured versus semi-structured data might be encoded can also be quite different. So you know that a generic web page containing text, if you are like an Anglophile, you would write it in English, I guess. Okay? And if you are into structured data and you like relational databases, you can use tuples and you can use SQL to query those tuples. Okay? And then in the middle is movie review, which is neither here nor there. Part of it is text, part of it is structured. So in fact, a standard language that's emerging for describing semi-structured data is XML. And it's really not that hard. All that it says is, apart from just the data, you should have description of what next couple of fields do. So you start an angle bracket and say, a name, angle bracket end, and then write some stuff and, you know, end it. Okay? So it's just, and then of course those, what's in those angle brackets, those are called the tags, and these tags wind up hopefully having some, basically these are the names of the fields. Okay? Now it turns out that XML can encode structured data. So if you have a bunch of tuples saying employee first name, employee last name, and the salary. So each row in the table is three fields. Okay, first name, last name, and salary. So I can write in XML. So first name begin, write the first name end, middle, second, and last name begin, write the last name end, and then salary begin, write the salary, salary end, and then write the whole of this. It looks as if I took a simple table and made it more longer by putting all this obvious information about the table headers, which is there at the top of the table. But it's useful if you're only sending a sum of the tuples. You know, the guy on the other side hasn't seen the top of the table. So they need to know what the fields are, and so you're describing the fields. Okay? So you can write XML, you can write a structured record in XML. You can write a text in XML, yes or no? Yes. You can say text, write whatever you want, and text. That's XML. Okay. In fact, there is also another interesting thing. Those of you who heard of XML, and we do it, we'll do some of these things towards the third part of the course. There's a lot that people expect. Just because you called something, let's say salary, you assume that the computer would understand everything that you understand about salaries. Okay? And what the computer understands is there is angle bracket begin, some gobbledygook, and then angle bracket end, and new kind of gobbledygook, and then the same gobbledygook here comes back again. That's the only thing it sees. Do you understand? It's not you read, oh, this is salary, ah, now I understand. Yeah, of course, you, if you are doing the processing, you don't need XML, you don't even need this stuff. You can actually see, yeah, given the table, this must be the salary, this must be the last name for that. Okay, meaning in programs comes because of the relationships between this object. Okay, and when you just said salary, you didn't necessarily say anything about what salary is. So you can actually expect too much from XML. But in XML, you can make up any tag, and people make up different tags. You know, so some another friend of yours who is converting this SQL data about employee salary might say first name, surname, because in fact, large number of countries in the world call last name surname. Okay, and so you don't get to laugh at it. That's just equally good name to say last name. And instead of salary, they might say compensation. Begin, compensation, end. Okay, so I have a company which has headquarters, one branch office in Phoenix, another branch office in Edinburgh, UK. So these guys would have the same exact tables but written completely different with completely different headers. And I want to know what is the total, what's the average salary of all the employees this company has. And you better have the ability to realize that compensation means the salary. Okay, and somewhere there should be that infrastructure which basically allows you to connect up the tag names and provide meaning so that you can actually process tags together. Okay?
Doesn't it put a more effort that you have to give a structured language? Because if one company pays salary and another compensation, they can be other third companies which pays A or B.
Mm-hmm.
When you write in query in XML, you keep on connecting all these tags. Is that difficult to do? Or
yeah.
Then you have to know everything which every
yeah.
company calls that.
Yeah.
So
what are the so the question is, nobody said how many languages are there in the world? I mean, you seem to be from India. You know, there are like what, 256 dialects in India. And we can't talk to each other anyway. Okay. So what do? And why do we expect our programs and our web to have any better success in communicating than we do? The way people communicate tends to be either by fiat, saying thou shalt speak this language. You know, if you want to be in this country, you better speak this language, otherwise the police will come and do something bad to you. Okay, that's one way. Okay, the other way is certain languages become more popular and so everybody seems to know this language. A third way is you have interpreters. So in UN there are, I mean, how many of you have seen this recent movie? I went on a flight and I had to see a movie, so I saw this movie. There was this Nicole Kidman movie. They also must have gone on a flight. But so there is this interpreter or something. What's the name of the movie? Interpreter. So it's all about this, you know, UN is full of these people who essentially will listen to random languages and translate them into random other languages. So that people from 150 different countries can act as if they understand each other before declaring a war. Okay. So the interesting thing is that we do these three different kinds of things in terms of connecting, and all those are equally relevant for XML, for web. One is global ontology. You heard the word ontology millions of times. Ontology is like a global ontology is a forced language. Thou shalt speak Esperanto. How many people know Esperanto? I mean, heard of Esperanto? Okay. Esperanto was global ontologies for human societies. People tried it. I mean, they just didn't have much of a power to push anybody, but I think about 7 to 9 people probably still speak Esperanto. So it's not really been a raging success. It was a language that people tried to make such that it has enough commonalities between what they thought was the most relevant language in the world, which for them was mostly Western European languages, and even they didn't care about those languages, and they hoped that the rest of the world would just pick it up as a second language so that there'll be more peace and quiet. Okay, and you see how that went. But that was their trial, we tried that. okay? And there are interpreters. So in the context of web, global ontologies is one thing that people try. The other is localized ontologies. So people in UK will use this ontology. People in US will use this ontology, and there would be a mapper between these ontologies. And then, you know, you go and you find that, you know, this time I was in UK, I couldn't eat. I mean, I'm a vegetarian, and normally I have 1.5 entrees on any menu that I can eat in most restaurants. And I lost one of them because in UK, wherever I go, there was where I expected vegetarian stuff, they would say they are using courgette or whatever. It turns out it's zucchini. I didn't know, and since I didn't know, and you know, I just assumed it must be something bad. You know, I shouldn't be eating it. And it turns out it's zucchini. I can eat zucchini, but I just didn't know, so I lost that problem. So it turns out that parts of UK actually use courgette to talk about zucchini. Other parts just say zucchini. So UK also doesn't have standard ontology. So hopefully you will have many, many hierarchical localized ontologies, and people will get busy translating them. And if this thing sounds like a crazy enterprise, you have to ask yourself, why do we want to do it? And the reason we want to do it is because the more structure we have, the more inferences we can make. Okay. Okay. Those are three different queries. And I think if you ever forget why structure helps querying, look at this query. You'll know. Okay. So the first query says, give me all the pages that have the keyword get rich quick. Every search engine can do it. Right? The second one says, give me the social security number of all the employees who have stayed with the company for more than 5 years and whose yearly salaries are 3 standard deviations away from the average salary. The database weebs can do it. If only they have databases. If you give them, you know, web, you can't do it. But it's a useful query. Just because you don't ask it every day doesn't mean it's not a useful query. Okay? A third one says, give me, and this one can be directly processed on fully structured data, relational data. This can't be processed on text data. The top one can be processed on text data. Here is another one which says, give me all the mails from people from ASU written this year which are relevant to get rich quick. This is actually connecting two different things. You want to say people from ASU, and the name doesn't tell you, I mean, the page doesn't tell you whether they're from ASU or not. You're hoping that in the email message, there are fields from which you can infer whether or not the message is from ASU. So that's the structured part of the query. And then the body, if it has get rich quick somewhere, then that's the unstructured part of the query. So you could do it in one way, which is you can either filter all the email messages and first look for all the ASU messages, and on that do the text processing, I mean text keyword search, or vice versa. But again, this is something that you cannot do if you think of pages as just text. There's another interesting phenomenon. How many of you know Sightseer? Okay. Has any graduate student not raised their hand? You're in trouble if you didn't. Okay, Sightseer is basically a computer science bibliography server which essentially keeps all the papers in their PDF form up there. That could be actually at the next class URL that you guys can look at. It's actually a very useful thing because Sightseer basically has links to all the electronic versions of the paper, so nobody no longer goes to Noble Library. They're just printing it away 15 times, which is good. What does Sightseer do? Apart from keeping records of all the web, all the computer science technical reports, conference papers, etc., they keep track of citations between papers. So if you go to a paper, they can tell you what papers it cites. They can also tell you what other papers cite this paper. What other papers cite this paper. Now this is a backlink. Okay? Except it's not a backlink in the usual web page form. You know, web page form backlink means somebody has put an Ahref and then pointed to the URL where this paper resides. But the way academic citation works is you just write a piece of text at the end of the paper saying, you know, Rao Kamam Party, title of the paper, and the conference in which it was published, the year of the conference. That's all you would do. Now, the citation information is extremely important in finance. In fact, you will notice that much of what Google does, the idea of Google PageRank essentially comes from citation analysis in academia. Okay, we are the smartest people in academia and we have nothing else to do to other than to figure out who is the smartest of the smartest people. And the way you try to do it is figure out who are the people whose papers are being cited by most other people. Not the other way around, which is who are the people who are writing the most papers. That doesn't mean anything. You don't write papers just so that you can stack them outside of your room. Okay? I mean, but the first paper you do it, you know, because you don't have even one to stack, so you write something and put it in Word or LaTeX and you feel good. But after a while, you're hoping that somebody out there is reading it and using your work to do more work and then making a citation to you. The more things get, more people cite your work, the more famous you are, in essence. That's the only coin of the realm. Google basically copied this. The more pages point to your page, the more important you are. Not just Google, authority sites, etc. All of these guys basically use the same idea and say, the more pages point to you, the more important you are. Okay. Now, so that's interesting point, that citations are actually like backlinks. But more importantly, how would you answer, I mean, first of all, to be able to actually make the citation linking across papers, how does CiteSphere do it? CiteSphere crawls for PDF files, PostScript files, and sometimes Word files. Okay? I mean, the number of Word files in computer science, Word files are very few. You know, most people wind up putting in PDF or PSS. But anyway, so it crawls these, and that's basically text. Worse than text, but basically text. Okay, how do you go from there to citation? Citations is structure. You are actually saying, I am referring to that other PDF file that you got before. How do you get that? You can ask people to say, thou shalt write papers which have a citation field which is encoded in relational databases, so that we can do this easily. Of course, you can't do it. So what does CiteSphere do? It extracts citations from PDF files. Remember I said if you don't have structure, you can extract it. Okay? So CiteSphere extracts citation from the PDF file. It's a very useful service it does. Okay? Without it, you cannot actually know who else is citing this paper. And if you are not even thinking of who else is citing this paper, you have poverty of imagination. It's not just looking at the paper, you want to know who else is actually using this paper to do more work. In the old days, before CiteSphere, okay, people would actually go to libraries, which would have this thing called citation index, which will come every month or every 2 months, where people, you know, maybe undergraduate or graduate students, would be asked to pore through, you know, journal papers and carefully say, this paper is being referred to by this journal's paper 7, this journal's paper 9, this journal's paper 25, and so those are all listed for you. And so when we go up to get our professorship and so on, we have to copy these pages. The larger your citation index is, in the sense the number of people citing your papers, the more famous you are. Now you don't have to do that. I don't have to go to library at all. In fact, CiteSphere, if you go to CiteSphere and ask the most top 10,000 most cited authors in computer science, it will give you a list of people who are cited. Okay? That's one way you can figure out whether or not, you know, somebody actually knows somebody exists. Okay? The reason I'm bringing this whole thing up is it actually nicely connects the idea of extracting structure from an unstructured source and using it to answer queries that you could not have answered without. Okay?
When the paper says it is cited some other paper, it always mentions the paper's name, the conference and the year. Isn't that a semi-structured kind of stuff?
That's what I'm saying.
Then you are always extracted. just crawl through the paper.
Yeah, you go through the page looking for the part where you think the references are. Do you actually, so there's a, how many of you know scholar.google.com, which is basically the new Sightseer. Sightseer is no longer being used. Scholar.google.com is being used more for the same exact purpose with some minor variation. Okay. And I heard a talk by the guy who made scholar.google.com, and he was talking about the number of different ways a single paper can be cited in a page, in a paper. Okay, any of you who actually wrote journal papers, how many of you have written journal papers? Okay, so when it comes to the Galley proof stage, people keep paining you, saying, you know, you should put all your, you know, citations in the standard format. Everybody wants to do it in a slightly different way. And, you know, these sites, the journals try to force you to do it in some standard format. And if you, and across journals, the standards for writing citations changes. And he said some ridiculously large number, like 85 or so different ways of citing the same paper. And they had to deal with all of them. All of them are talking about the same exact paper. Okay? And I don't mean to say by any chance that the information extraction is fully I had a nice example, let me see if I can find it. By the way, this is the most important query you should use for anything. Let's see. If I find it, I'll share it to you. But there was a paper that we wrote, basically whose title was Learning Methods in Planning, Looking Back, Taking Stock, Going Forward. Okay, and this is a two-line heading. So I was very pleased to see that people called LBAC, T-Stock, and G forward have written the same paper. Did you understand what happened? They basically took the second line of the title as the author's name, Google Scholar. So LBAC and G stock, T stock and G forward are getting all our citations. These guys don't even exist, unfortunately. That's the bad part. But you know, extraction is not foolproof, but it's better to do partial extraction than nothing at all. Because you're able to then answer queries such as, you know, who is citing whom. And even further, here is the interesting thing. Sightseer actually does this well, and scholar.google doesn't do as well. One way you can increase the number of citations you have is what? Of course, you can pay your friends to cite you, but that you don't have. Just keep writing more and more papers. Right? And each paper you write, you cite all the previous papers. It's a nice pyramid scheme. Right? And in fact, you know this as a grad student, you know that it's very important to cite all your advisor's papers, and by the second paper onwards, you cite all your advisor's papers and your papers. Okay? Basically, this is what you would like to do. And now, unfortunately, from a scientific point of view, those are useless citations. Me patting my back is not the same as you patting my back. Even if you are patting my back and I'm patting your back, that's still, slightly better than me just directly cutting the middleman out and patting my back directly. Okay. So the question is, Sightseer, when you look at the Sightseer citation, by the way, you should do all this when you go home. You look at a paper and it will show all the citations for this paper, and it will put the citations by the author to their own papers in an ugly pink, saying you are narcissistic, right? So it doesn't count them. Now here's my question. How does Sightseer know this? How does Sightseer know that you are citing your own paper? Yeah, so think about this. What it is doing is, you should look for the paper which is in the bottom of the PDF file somewhere, look at the author's names and make sure none of them appear in the beginning part of the paper. Now all of these are ill-defined. There is no correct standard for beginning part of the paper, there is no correct standard for the end of the paper. Okay, and yet doing that is very useful, to the extent you would agree with me that when you count citations, you should count citations by others to your work rather than you to your own. Okay. By the way, since we've been talking so much about citations, I should mention that, you know, the pyramid scheme, the chain letter schemes, right? You know, where people say, this was before web, you know, there are chain letter schemes. Now, of course, spam filters cut them off, but you would get these things where they'll say, you know, something has been done and somebody, so you are getting this letter, all you need to do is to make 8 copies and forward to other people, plus send me $10. And what happens then is that those 7 people who got these copies will send you $10, and so sooner or later you'll become rich, don't worry. Now this is the usual pyramid scheme. And the usual way pyramid schemes fail is the last guy has nobody who sends money to him. Now there's a nice version of it for academia, which I love, which is basically it says, he gets this letter and says, researcher, dear researcher, we want to improve your tenure chances, your ability to, you know, get a job and so on. So what you should do is, you know, there are 8 names on this letter, you know, scratch off your name, I mean, scratch off the top name, add your name to the bottom of the list, and for the next 4 papers you write, cite all these 7 people. And the following will happen to you. In 3 years, your citation count would just skyrocket. And even, you know, Sightseer and scholar.google can't catch it, you know, you see what I'm saying? But it's a nice variation on the usual pyramid scheme. But anyway, so I think we went farther than I expected, but I think it's useful to know, because partly because I am surprised that many of you are only thinking of small variations that you can do to Google. And I guess the kind of examples that people were giving in the beginning of the class are still far away from what Sightseer can already do, which is to extract structure from unstructured data and use it to support better queries than could be supported with raw text. There is no way you could tell me whether I am citing myself if you don't have a notion of structure. Because are you being cited? Yeah, if your name appears in the paper, you're citing. You're being cited. But then what if my name appears in the paper more than once? Well, maybe you're still being cited. What if it appears more than once, but one of the times it appears in the header? Then you are not being cited. But then to talk about that, I need to talk about headers, which is structure. Okay, that's basically, so that's the part that I wanted to talk about as far as that was concerned, as far as the structure was, the semi-structured data was concerned. And I think this essentially is saying that to do these sorts of things, you can wind up using some existing disciplines. One is information and text retrieval, which we'll get started on today. The other is databases. I mentioned databases many, many times today, right? And the third is extracting information, basically finding clusters of sources and so on, all of which are mining. And I gave examples of mining last class. That could be used. Now, in all these cases, these things actually existed before web came about. You know, information retrieval existed before web came about. But you wind up, web winds up putting extra demands, new types of demands, and you need to handle that. And similarly, databases existed before web came along, and web puts new types of problems, in particular multiple data sources all over the place, using different column names for the same field. Okay, and so you need to have to deal with this heterogeneity of naming, for example, and lots of other things too. And similarly for the machine learning too, machine learning and data mining existed. Part of what happens on the web is large scale of data and differences in requirements. It turns out that oftentimes accuracy may be less important than efficiency. We'll talk about this later. I mean, if your clustering engine takes 15 hours to find the truly good clusters for your query, okay, and give you the answer, we don't want to stand there. So your search engine would be dead. So very important to come up with clusters fast. And if you come up with clusters so fast, most of the time you are not getting the right cluster. But that's okay, we deal with that. Okay, so that's the kind of way these disciplines change because of the internet.
What? On what basis do you actually form these clusters?
You talked about again, this is the answer to this question makes me jump. But on the other hand, the whole class today I've been jumping to the rest of the semester. So let me jump that too, which is the way you cluster anything is in terms of a distance metric. So clustering is best understood as if I give you some points in an n-dimensional space. You know, for the simplicity case, just assume some points in two-dimensional space. Now I'm trying to find clusters. Okay. So the right way to find clusters depends upon how do you define distance. And when I look at points on the two-dimensional space, I can see, these things are far away, these things are closer. And normally you do two things at the same time in trying to cluster. One is, within the cluster, the distance between individual points should be as little as possible. And across the clusters, the distance between points from one cluster to other cluster should be as far as possible. And you write a computer program to do this. I mean, another them to do this. Now, there are two important issues there. One, of course, is how to write such algorithms, which is not hard. The second is much more interesting issue is how do you define the distance. By changing the notion of how you define the distance, you can change the notion of clusters completely. For example, given a set of computer science papers, okay? And I can give you two distance measures saying whether or not two papers are close enough. Okay, I mean basically a distance measure and a similarity measure are essentially one and the same. You know, in one, the distance, inverse of the distance is similarity and vice versa. Okay, so if I say distance, I'm also talking about similarity. So if I give you two papers and, you know, I have to give you similarity measures between these two papers. I'll describe two ways of defining similarity measures for computer science papers that you can understand. One is how many words are common between these papers. The obvious one. The more words come on, the more similar. The less words come on, the less similar. The second is how many papers seem to cite these two papers at the same time. Everybody who is citing this paper are also citing this paper, so it must be they have much more similar. These are two different notions of distance. You can use the same clustering algorithm. You know, we'll talk about a bunch of them, k-means or any of these. But input the text similarity metric, you would get a separate type of clustering. Input the co-citation similarity metric, you get a different cluster. Okay? So what's important is figuring out what are the right distances. Other questions? We will talk about this again later, but I think it's a reasonable question to ask here. This is just the longer version of that slide. Okay, so what I want to do in the remaining time is to get started towards text processing, which is basically information retrieval part of the course, which is the closest you get to the usual text, the search engine. Okay. Oh, it went away by itself. Okay. So what is the information retrieval, the traditional model? You know, given a set of documents, and a query expressed as a set of keywords, okay, you have to return a ranked set of relevant documents. Okay, now why is this different from databases?
Database is everything equally ranked.
Database is everything is equally ranked. Point one, what point two? What other things are there? So either a tuple is an answer to the query or not an answer to the query. There is no, it is 50% answer to the query. And yet information retrieval is all about that. And there's a third important reason why information retrieval is very different from databases. By the way, I'm using the database analogy a lot because all of you, I think most of you said you have done database courses. Okay, for those of you who didn't, come and talk to me. I'll show you some refresher things that you can read beforehand so that you can follow the discussion. Okay, so I'll use databases as an example to contrast to information retrieval. So it looks as if it's very much similar to database retrieval, except there are some different words such as ranking and the word relevance. Okay. Relevance in database scenario is binary, one or zero. Either the query, either a tuple is relevant to the query or it's not. There's no in between. Information retrieval, it can be 0.99 relevant, 0.87 relevant, 0.34 relevant, and so on. Because it has these degrees, you need to rank the answers so that the more relevant answers come first and the lesser relevant answers come next. Now, a second issue is how do you evaluate a database processor when you are trying to decide whether to buy the database manager from IBM or from somebody else, I guess, you know, Oracle. How do you evaluate them? The lowest level.
Response time.
The fastest you come back, the better off you are. In information retrieval, I say that two important ideas are used. One is precision, the other is recall. Okay? Precision is how many of the results that the search engine is returning to you are actually relevant to the query. Recall is how many of the relevant results are you eventually returning. Why don't we talk about precision and recall for databases? Okay. So in the case of databases, you expect 100% precision, 100% recall. Nothing else would cut it. So since everybody will give 100% precision, 100% recall, then the only way you can compare two databases is what color they come in or how fast they are. Okay. So we look at how fast they are. That looks like a better idea. Okay. Whereas information retrieval systems, on the other hand, they differ on precision and recall. So it's possible that I have an information retrieval engine or a search engine S1 which has very high precision but very low recall. The other one has very low precision, very high recall. Which is better? It depends. Depends is the answer. Okay. By the way, have any of you taken the witness stand? In court, you can admit. I must have seen enough movies, the court cases, so on, where witnesses stand up, right, and the judge says you should swear in first. Not swear at the judge, but swear in first. And they ask you to say something. What do they say? What's the usual thing in English? I swear.
I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Whole truth and nothing but the truth. Why? Why that redundancy? Why not just the truth? Did you ever think about that? Why not just say, courts are already backlogged, why make people talk longer sentences? Why not just stand up and say, I swear to tell the truth? Exactly, there's nice analogy between the whole truth and nothing but the truth and precision and recall. Okay, what's 100% precision? What is 100% precision? In the whole truth and nothing but truth. Those are the two pieces. What does 100% precision mean?
Truth.
No. Truth is different. I have two different pieces. Whole truth, nothing but the truth. If a witness is 100% precise, think about this. By the way, precision and recall are interesting concepts, and I want you to give you multiple reasons to remember them so that you'll never again forget it. I already heard somebody saying whole truth and somebody saying nothing but the truth. This doesn't look like whole and nothing but the truth. So which is it? Is it whole truth or nothing but the truth?
Nothing but the truth.
So in the context of search engine, precision means in the first few, basically, and the high up in the ranking, you get the most relevant results. That's what precision means. Okay, and so whatever you give better be relevant, and that's nothing but the truth in our analogy. And the guy who has 100% recall corresponds to whole truth. And you can have a chatty whole truth guy who is not only telling you all the truth plus other things too, and you can also have somebody who just say I am 40 and keep shut. So that guy is 100% precise, but basically not telling the whole truth. Okay? So precision and recall are whole truth or nothing but the truth, and databases are required to give both. Information retrieval systems are not required. Now, why are information retrieval systems not required to give both 100% precision and 100% recall? Why don't they do it? Is it because of intellectual laziness? It's not necessary? Who decides the relevance of an answer to the query? Do we get to lobotomize our user beforehand and figure out what do they have in their head when they give the query? Then I say keyword Bush, okay, and the top answer is Kalahari Bushman, I will be very happy, and you know the campus Republicans will be very unhappy. Who is right? Both are right. You know, for with respect to my relevance metric, darn good Bush, okay, and with respect to their relevance metric, my God, what a bad search engine. The point I'm trying to make is relevance is in the head of the person who is asking the question. And what happens really is, this is a nice picture. This guy has something, you know, appropriately represented by clouds in his or her head. This is what they want to find answer to. And they are trying to project this query into keywords. The projection is highly lossy. It's not lossless at all. So what they're looking for and what they're asking are completely different. I mean, sometimes they're sort of related, but they're not at all the exact point. Okay. So for example, think about this. The question, the English question, do you have the time? You know, when I first came to US, many people would ask me, do you have the time? I said, yeah. And nobody was becoming my friend. And it was getting hard. And I was answering their query, and apparently what they wanted is, if you have the time, tell me the time. And I was answering their query, which is, do you have the time? Yes, I do. Okay, for lots of things. We do this all the time. So in information retrieval, what's happening is the keywords, which is even worse, I mean, it's not even a question, it's not even a full language question. The keyword that you have is only very loosely connected to what you really want to find out about. However, since you are the user, you get to yell at the search engine if it did not figure out what you were thinking about and give the right answer. So the reason we actually wind up thinking about precision and recall rather than 100% precision and 100% recall is because you can't solve the other problem. There is no way of solving the other problem. There is no answer because everybody has a different relevance metric. So now how do search engines get evaluated normally? What do? They get focus groups. When objective truth cannot be attained, you get focus groups. Okay, so they will show a bunch of people, here are the keywords that are submitted, here are the results. According to your own understanding of this keyword and these results, pick which are the relevant results and which are the irrelevant results. And they'll do this and find out what is the precision and recall, average precision and recall, as measured by focus group folks over a bunch of queries. In databases, you don't get to do that. Okay, I mean, you don't get to ask people, do you think the answer is right? I mean, I don't get to ask, there's only one answer, and either you give the full answer or you don't. Okay? One final slide, and I think we should be able to go. I've been using the word precision and recall, and here's just a picture showing how precision and recall are actually measured. Okay, so if the search engine has returned PP tuples in the first page, okay, and the total number of tuples in the first page are TP plus FP, that means these TP, I'm sorry, the total number of tuples the search engine returned are TP plus FP. Of which TP are the true positives, TP means true positive, that means they're truly relevant. FP are false positives, that means these are irrelevant pages that the search engine thought was relevant to you. then the precision at that point for that search engine is defined as essentially the fraction TP by TP plus FP. The fraction of true positives to true positives plus false positives that you have returned. That's precision. Okay? The recall, on the other hand, is the number of true positives you returned divided by the number of true positives you returned plus the number of false negatives, the ones that you did not return, in essence, because you decided they were not relevant. Okay? Recall is all about what you did not give, but should have given. And precision is all about what you shouldn't have given, but you gave. And in general, precision versus recall curves, if you plot precision and recall, sort of goes like this. If you want high recall, normally your precision starts falling down. Okay? So if you want to say a lot, sooner or later you will start talking about irrelevant stuff. That's basically what it's saying. Okay? Now, given two search engines, suppose I have a couple of search engines like this, one which has a precision recall curve like this. And I'll talk about this again next class, but to be ended here. And another has a precision recall curve like this. And a third one has a precision recall curve like this. So at any point, basically, you can see what its precision recall are. Okay? Which would you rather not have as your information retrieval engine? For sure. This guy. This guy is always has the lower precision and lower recall. So he's always dominated by the other guy. Among these two, which would you rather have? You can't tell. Among these two, which would you rather have if you are a web user? Second, why? Did people understand that? If you are a web user, the most important thing for you is what comes up in the top 10 results. In fact, there is all sorts of nice industry things about how the top 10 results is the real estate, the best real estate, and you want to break into it. If you're 11th, you are out of sight and out of mind because nobody actually looks at the second page of the search engine. So in web search, the most important thing, because of the way we use the web, is high precision, even at the expense of recall. In web search, the most important thing is high precision, even at the expense of recall. This is not true for all information retrieval scenarios. As an example, if you are a medical doctor who just saw a patient with various types of funny symptoms and they're trying to find out whether the literature contains anything about this particular kind of disease, so they went to the medical papers repository and gave this query. And there are two search engines, method one and method two, which can answer this guy's query. Which would they rather take? What? The one which has higher recall. Because you would much rather look at everything that is relevant, possibly relevant to this poor guy's disease, than say, I just look at the first three and, you know, if the guy dies, the guy. Okay? So the point I'm trying to make is, in truly speaking, precision and recall are two independent dimensions, both of which are relevant, both of which are very important. In web search, it turns out, precision turns out to be more important than recall. If I give you two search engines, both of which have the same precision, but one has higher recall, I would take the one with higher recall. Okay? Now, if you can't tell which is the better one, precision or recall, there is a way of combining both such that you can have apples and oranges. You don't know which you like better, so you add apples and oranges, right? And you say the most number of fruits or something. So if you can't tell whether you like precision or recall, is there a way in which you can combine precision and recall into a single number? Yeah, you can always combine two numbers into a single number. Add them, multiply, divide, whatever. Okay? The usual idea is to actually think in terms of means, the average. But there are three different averages that you should be familiar with. The arithmetic mean, the geometric mean, and what? The harmonic mean. I wrote the formulas for both, all of them. P being precision, R being recall. I told you three different ways of combining them. What would you rather take, given what you know about precision and recall? the best search engines have both high precision and high recall. Okay, so if you are combining them, you better have the combination, better have the property that it has high values only when both of them are high. And if even one of them is low, it will have a low value. Okay, of all the means, only harmonic mean has that property. Okay, so if precision is 1 and recall is 1, this is 1. If precision is 0 and recall is 1, this would be 1 by 0 is what? 1 by 0 is defined, guys. Infinity, right? So 1 by 2 by infinity, 0. If recall is 0 and precision is 1, it will also be 0. So this would be 1 only when both precision and recall are high. These two don't have that property. So in fact, if you must combine them into one single number, people actually combine precision and recall using the harmonic mean. And this is called the F measure. Okay? So we'll stop here. The main points we talked about essentially are information retrieval engines depend, I mean, they are very different from databases in the sense that there is no objective truth. The objective truth is essentially this slippery slope idea of relevance, which is judged by an outside user. And so different search engines might fare differently in terms of how many relevant results they gave and how many irrelevant results they gave on the way to relevant results. Okay? So I can have, okay, here is an interesting thing that you can think of. Can you give me a search engine which has 100% recall if I don't care about precision? What? We've been locked out. Can you give a search engine which has 100% recall very easily if I don't care about precision at all? Just return the database. So I ask a question and Google says, here is my database of URL. 100% recall, you know, to the extent they have crawled every possible page in the world, 100% recall. How do you get 100% precision? Don't return anything at all. That's not a bad idea. Although 0 by 0 is not actually defined, but mostly you want to be very precise, and if you want to speak nothing but the truth, they say, I don't want to say bad things about you, I would rather keep quiet. That's the usual thing. You know, what that means is they only have bad things to say about you. Okay, so it's possible to generate search engines which are highly precise with zero recall. It's possible also to generate search engines which are high recall but zero precision. The trick is, of course, to have both. And given that search engines tend to go towards more precision, less recall side. It's not that they want zero recall. Okay, it's just they want more precision and less recall. Okay. And then we talked, of course, about precision and recall and how they are different from the database models of completeness and database models where you expect that everything has 100% precision as well as recall. Okay. Yes, sir. No, I think, again, as to which one do you really like, as to precision and recall, the best I can show you, by the way, this is, you know, if you have to think about that, these are called multi-objective optimization problems. You have two different objectives. I want to be happy, I want to be rich. I want to be happy, I want to have high GPA. You know, multiple different objectives, sometimes conflicting. And the question then is, how do you decide which strategy is better? Normally, the only thing you can say is what are dominated strategies. This poor guy is dominated. Okay, and these two are not dominating each other. So you just have to show them to the user, and the user then has to say. And of course, if the user says, you don't have to ask me, here is a linear combination of 5 times precision plus 7 times recall divided by pi squared is my utility. That's fine, we'll just apply it. Okay, but that's user dependent. You cannot really have a general idea. And the most general I can get is harmonic mean is better than the other two means. And in fact, F measure is used a lot. Okay. Next class, we will talk about obvious models for retrieval in information retrieval using Boolean, bag-based model, and vector space model.